Bookers, welcome to The Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles. Can you believe it's nearly May? Spring is flying by, and summer happily looms in the not-too-distant future. I'm thinking it's not too early to begin planning your summer getaway. I always find that avid readers are often passionate travelers. After all, a great book is an escape, whether to far-off lands or to uncharted landscapes of the heart and mind. This week, we'll travel around the globe and across our coasts on fascinating histories of less-traveled regions and compelling journeys of discovery. In doing so, I believe we'll see that one of the most revelatory aspects of travel is its ability to unlock the secret corners of yourself. Join me now as we turn to page one of the book report. The Book Report begins our travel show by journeying with Pamela Olson, a small-town girl from eastern Oklahoma. As her memoir begins, Pamela finally has what she always wanted, a physics degree from Stanford. But instead of feeling excited for what comes next, she felt consumed by dread and confusion. To achieve some much-needed clarity, Pamela put distance between herself and her problems. Fast Times in Palestine, a love affair with a homeless homeland, chronicles Pamela's journey from aimless ex-bartender to Ramallah-based journalist and foreign press coordinator for a Palestinian presidential candidate. During her time in the Middle East, Pamela found herself attending Yasser Arafat's funeral, tour guiding Israeli friends around the West Bank, dating a Palestinian from a conservative village, being held at gunpoint, and witnessing the 2005 disengagement from inside the Gaza Strip. Her memoir focuses not only on violence and politics, but also on the daily rounds of house parties, concerts, barbecues, weddings, and romance that happened in between. Julia Farhat narrates.
They were on their way to Petra, the ancient Nabataean city carved into the living rock of a canyon in southern Jordan. Its most striking landmark is a matchless monument called El Khesni, which famously served as the final resting place of the Holy Grail in the film Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. The massive, shimmering, rose-hued tomb, exquisitely ornamented and symmetrical, is accessible only through a mile-long crack in a mountain. Sebastian found me the next day and invited me to join him in Yusuf. I hesitated. I'd already gone to Petra a week earlier, and going again would cut into my dwindling time and funds. But I had, after all, just been invited to one of the most magical places on Earth in the company of one of the most intriguing people I had ever met. I didn't hesitate long. Along the way, Yusuf mentioned he had trained in survival in the Sudan from age 14 to 22, and he claimed to have met Osama bin Laden during that time. Yusuf had also lived in a cave in southern Spain for several years. Now he was on the town council of a hilltop Palestinian village called Jayus. He spoke fluent Arabic. Sebastian and I once watched him silence an entire busload of Jordanians with his sing-song recitation of the Quran. Both men talked compulsively about their experiences in Palestine. Yusuf was sometimes offhand, almost clinical as he told his stories. Other times he was wide-eyed, like a kid describing a crime so outrageous he feared no one would believe him. As we were heading back to Amman, I asked Yusuf and Sebastian if I could go with them when they went back to the West Bank. "You're welcome to join us," Sebastian said, "but you might get turned back at the Israeli border if the guards suspect you plan on visiting the West Bank. It's better not to mention anything about that." "And it's probably best if we pretend we don't know each other," Yusuf said in his clipped patrician accent. "The interrogations will be much simpler that way." So, green and wide-eyed, I wandered into the Holy Land, an empty vessel.
That was Fast Times in Palestine by Pamela Olson. Paul Theroux is a book report favorite. As travel enthusiasts, we anxiously look forward to each new title. The Last Train to Zona Verde, My Ultimate Africa Safari, is the final African adventure from the writer whose effortless prose has brought the world to generations of fans. Journeying alone in what he feels will be his last African journey, Theroux encounters a world increasingly removed from both the itineraries of tourists and the hopes of post-colonial independence movements. Having traveled down the right-hand side of Africa in Dark Sar Safari, he sets out this time from Cape Town, heading northward up the left-hand side through South Africa and Namibia to Botswana, heading for the Congo in search of the end of the line. Described by some readers as the author's cranky book, the book report believes it is perhaps a book based on years of firsthand African experience. In this journey, the author has failed to pack his rose-colored glasses and offers a realistic assessment of the region. John McDonough narrates.
Traditional hunter-gatherers, they had no history of using money. Even now, pushed to the margins of so-called Bushman land, they knew this part of it as Nainai, and irregularly settled with some cattle and crops. These people seldom saw money and hardly used the decaying stuff. They still supplemented their diet by hunting and grubbing and foraging, and accepting pitiful handouts. They probably did not think about money, or if they did, they knew they would never have any. As the Greeks rioted, howling against their government, and Italians cried poverty in the streets of Rome, and the Portuguese and the Spanish stared hollow-eyed at bankruptcy, and the news was of failure, worthless currencies, and austerity measures, the Jutwasi were indestructible in all their old ways, or seemed so to me in my ignorance. The young woman in front of me dropped to her knees in the sand. She had the lovely, elfin, somewhat Asiatic face, but also suggesting the face of an extraterrestrial, that most San people possess. That is to say, pedomorphic, the innocent and fetching face of a child. She traced her fingers around a thread-like vine sprouting from the sand, crouched, leaned on one elbow, and began digging. With each scoop and handful of sand, her eyes brightened, her breasts shook, and her nipples trembled against the earth, one of the minor titillations of this excursion. Within a minute, she extracted a finger-shaped tuber from the dark, strangely moist hole she'd made, and cradled it in her hand. As she flicked dust from the root, it paled beneath her fingertips. Smiling, she offered the first bite to me. "Nano," she said, and the word was translated as potato. It had the crunch, the mouthfeel, the sweetish earthen taste of raw carrot. I passed it back, and it was shared equally, a nibble each, 9 bites. In the forests, deserts, and hillsides across the world, foraging people like the Jutwasi are scrupulous about sharing food. It is this sharing in their communal life that binds them together. Ahead of us, kneeling on scattered nutshells and the leaf litter of a thorn bush, 2 of the men, facing each other on the ground, were taking turns spinning a 2-foot-long stick between their palms, chafing this spindle which very shortly raised a puff of smoke from the friction of its bottom end in a darkening piece of soft wood. The stick they call male, the dimpled woodblock on the bottom female. Sparks glowed from the hot drilled block, and one of the men coaxed more sparks, lifting the glowing, gently smoking wood, blowing on it with lips framed in a kissing expression. He scattered shells and dead leaves on it, then a handful of twigs. We had fire. Strikes in Greece have cut off power in many cities, and the government is expected to default on its debt, plunging Europe into deepening uncertainty, putting the fate of the euro in doubt. The ripple effect could endanger the viability of American banks. Rock-throwing mobs protesting mounting austerity measures have begun looting shops in Athens.
That was The Last Train to Zona Verde by Paul Theroux. Tom Zollner is the author of four nonfiction books, including Uranium, winner of the 2011 American Institute of Physics Science Writing Award. His nonfiction writing has been called genre-defying, with its trademark blend of history, travelogue, and literary reportage. Tom has worked as a reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle and the Arizona Republic, and as a contributing editor at Men's Health magazine. He's now an associate professor at Chapman University. Today we'll speak with Tom about his new title, Train, Riding the Rails That Created the Modern World. Welcome, Tom, and thanks for joining us today on The Book Report.
Thanks for having me.
Your book is not only a love story to riding the rails. It looks at the history of trains, their impact on the world's economy, and how trains are changing the world. Why did you undertake this project?
I can think of no other machine that's had such an influence on the way we live today, from the way our cities are arranged, from the way that nations deal with each other, from the kind of food that we eat to the beat of our music. Plus, they're just a whole lot of fun to ride.
Right. It's 2014, and I love trains, but why are so many of us still fascinated by train travel?
Well, there's something very sensory about this this method of moving. There's just sort of the rocking of the carriages. There's the clicking of the wheels. The sort of blur of what's going on outside the windows. Those listeners who ride trains will know that you see parts of cities that you never see in any other way. And so this is a way to sort of see America close up, if you like.
Right. Early in the book, you said the train is a diorama for what Britain used to be and what it may still become. Explain that.
Great Britain, where the railroad was invented, of course, in the 1820s, really became a world power, not just through the might of the sea, but also through extending rails throughout the British Isles. And the British were the champion railroad builders of the 19th century. They built the fantastic system in India, to name one example. Wherever they built colonies, they also built railroads. And this began to atrophy. In the 1960s, and particularly in the 1970s, they began to chop routes back home, and the sense of the rails lies deep in the British unconsciousness. And as they experience more and more crowded highways, more frustration with high fuel prices, I see rail travel as an excellent solution for their problems.
I was fascinated to learn that many top publishers today, like Hachette, W.H. Smith, even Penguin, have early connections to trains. How so?
Isn't that amazing?
Yes.
Because the experience of sort of sitting there on a train waiting to get to your journey, that was a new thing for the human consciousness. And carriages were arranged in such a way that people faced each other, and we still see this today on U.S. trains. You know, there's some cars where, you know, you go take a seat and you're looking at the guy across from you directly in the eye, and this was regarded as sort of a kind of an awkward sort of situation. The boredom of travel was obviously a factor, and publishers realized, well, here's a way that we can put something in someone's hands that they won't be awkwardly looking at their, you know, stranger companion, and have something to do on this journey. And so the act of reading while traveling became very important.
Right. Okay, this blew me away. You wrote that the inspiration for Rhapsody in Blue came to George Gershwin while journeying on a train from New York to Boston. Tell us that story.
Yes, in 1924.
Tell us.
He was offered the chance to write an experimental symphony, and he was sort of stuck. He couldn't think of an idea, and it was on the train, he said, that he began to hear the music, you know, that wonderful, lush, symphonic composition of Rhapsody in Blue that we customarily associate with the skyline of Manhattan. Actually, the true story is when we hear Rhapsody in Blue, we're actually listening to the railroad.
Hmm. The rails also had a significant impact on Walt Disney. In what way?
Well, Walt Disney was absolutely fascinated with trains. He grew up in Marceline, Missouri, which was a division point on the Atchison, Topeka, and Santa Fe. And the motion of it, the romance, the adventure, it always appealed to him. And so after the movie Fantasia sort of failed at the box office, Walt Disney sort of withdrew into himself, and he had a very thoughtful period. He began to build this like model railroad in his backyard, and suffering from kind of a depression, a friend suggested, "Hey, why don't you go to the 1948 railroad fair that they're having in Chicago, where you know the big carriers had put on these big demonstrations? You know, they had these lands that were quite similar to what would eventually become the different partitions of Disneyland, you know, the Frontierland, Fantasyland, Tomorrowland, the roots of Disneyland and Disney World, the Magic Kingdom, that's in the railroad."
Hmm. Wow. We're speaking with Tom Zollner on the Book Report. The book describes many of the train journeys you undertook: England, the Trans-Siberian, India, Peru. Is there one that impacted you more than the others?
You know, I think it was seeing my own country, actually, from the window of a train. Less than 2% of Americans have ever been on an inner-city passenger train, long distance from city to city. And, you know, despite riding the Trans-Siberian, riding the coal train through Peru, across India, really one of the most exotic journeys I took, I have to say, was across America.
That statistic astounds me. Does that include the Northeast Corridor? I mean, people that take, you know, the Boston, New York, or New York, Washington?
Yeah, it does. You know, those who ride trains tend to be regular riders, regular commuters, or those who just enjoy this method of conveyance so much that they're willing to abide the kind of mediocre service of Amtrak.
Hmm. All right. I was kind of interested to learn that there was never any murder on the Orient Express.
There never was. There was an ambiguous incident where a U.S. military attaché like wound up on the side of the tracks, having been jumped or pushed. But as for you know, a straight out homicide, no, it never happened.
That probably breaks the heart of lots of mystery lovers.
And ruins the romance.
Right. Speaking of train lovers, is there one journey out there you would recommend for, let's say, a beginning train lover?
I would suggest two, particularly in the North American continent. Go up to Toronto and ride the train across Canada that goes all the way to Vancouver. It's going to take you a couple of days, but oh, you're not going to regret it. And then for a bit shorter of a journey, Chicago to Seattle shows you the same contrast in between plains and mountains, and it's absolutely magnificent.
Hmm. Okay, what's your opinion of the future of trains in the world and in the United States?
There is a lot of potential in this method of conveyance. We've turned our back on it. We treat it as an antique, but nevertheless, it is incredibly fuel efficient. It's a civilized way to travel. I do want to be a realist, however. They are expensive to build. It takes a while to build popular support. California is still on track with the high-speed rail express from L.A. to San Francisco. Best-case scenario, we'll see that in 2028. It's not going to be a utopia. You know, it still has its costs, its drawbacks. But when it comes to the future of rail travel, I'd like to think I'm a realistic romantic.
Any final thoughts?
Only to say that when it comes to riding the trains that we do have and being optimistic about the future of rail in the United States and the world, all I can say is all aboard.
Okay. All right, Tom, thanks so much for joining us today.
It was a pleasure, Elaine.
All righty. Bye.
Bye-bye.
And now, let's hear a sampling of Train, performed by Grover Gardner.
My trip to my workplace takes a reliable 47 minutes, and I don't do it as an act of rebellion against the oil companies or as an ideological protest against my car. I do it because it is relatively cheap, and it saves me from the freeway. And while I usually tote a book, I more often stare out the window at one of the truly ancient vistas of California. A corridor lined with pipe-fitting yards, crinkled tin warehouses, oil pump jacks, and homeless encampments. Anyone who rides an American train can see that old industrial hardpan where the money is made without pretense, and which was often, especially in the West, the first line slashed on the map before any major population showed up. And in this case, it's the tracks of the old Atchison, Topeka, and Santa Fe that came through in 1885 to steal some orange hauling business from the Southern Pacific. This right-of-way is now leased by Metrolink, a perfectly decent commuter rail line that runs to three counties and is shockingly underused. When I tell people I take the train to work, I often get a confused look. Is that even possible? And then a look of envy. You can read. You can do work. You can listen to your iPod. All of those things, yes. But the clacking motion of the train, the way it shudders as if being pulled by a spinnaker sail, its uncanny, unlikely grace, often compels me to watch the old light industrial panorama spool past. And I feel transported into a lulling sense of mystery, a sense of past and present merging into a single continuum. This is a private feeling, but on the train one is almost never alone. The world was so much smaller than we thought, wrote Charles Dickens at the dawn of the railroad era in Britain. We were all connected. People supposed to be far apart were constantly elbowing each other. The very first rail passengers felt a sense of oceanic awe, even verging into dread, at their first sight of a train. A locomotive was the world's first true machine ever put on wide public display. A golem of gears that made loud gasps of expiration, much like an animal's breath. Watching it creep forward came as a shock to the psyche, for this wagon was not pulled by a living animal, which would have been readily understandable. This was a grotesque and ghostly apparition. When crowds gathered in 1825 to watch the debut of the world's first real railroad, the Stockton and Darlington of northern Britain, the correspondent from the Morning Herald reported that multiple spectators fled in affright from the locomotive, and others looked at the train with a vacant stare, as if in a trance. This experience was repeated thousands of times. Wherever the train would be introduced, observers responded with confusion and even horror. The editor of the Cincinnati Enquirer saw crowds dumbfounded at the strange and unusual spectacle, with distended eyes, in 1846. Another newspaper said witnesses at LaSalle, Illinois, stood dumb with amazement when the first engine of the Illinois Central came through. Many of them looked as though they had come out between the shakes of the fever and ague, noted the reporter. The Bengal Hurkaru newspaper said the test of a locomotive near Calcutta astonished nearly all present with its snort and its whistle and its fiery speed. Some made motions to bow and worship. Others considered the whistle the voice of a demon and believed that its sound would curdle milk, its smoke would kill birds, and its vibrations dry up women's fertility.
We've just heard Train by Tom Zollner. Labyrinth of Kingdoms, 10,000 Miles Through Islamic Africa by Steve Kemper is a true history that rivals the travels of Burton or Stanley for excitement. and surpasses them in scientific achievements. In 1849, Heinrich Barth joined a small British expedition into unexplored regions of Islamic North and Central Africa. One by one, his companions died, but he carried on alone, eventually reaching the fabled city of gold, Timbuktu. His 5.5-year, 10,000-mile adventure ranks among the greatest journeys in the annals of exploration and offers important source materials for African scholars. Yet because of shifting politics, European preconceptions, and his own thorny personality, Barth has been almost forgotten. Most people have never heard of him, his epic journey, or his still pertinent observations about Africa and Islam. His monumental 5-volume Travels and Discoveries in North and Central Africa is rare, even in libraries. Ed Phillips narrates the book that brings the discoverer to the forefront.
European commerce couldn't flourish in Africa if Europeans couldn't survive there. The continent's rulers and warlords had to be courted. Agreements that protected European traders had to be signed. The anarchy caused by bandits and freebooters along the trade routes had to be squelched. European merchants also needed to know which European products the Africans craved and which African products might be profitably imported. Much needed to be done before commerce and Christianity had any chance of civilizing Africa by exploiting its resources. This had been Richardson's appeal to Lord Palmerston at the Foreign Office 18 months earlier, and he repeated it in a letter in September 1848. This time, Palmerston responded. On September 30, he asked Richardson to submit a proposal with routes, a timetable, and an estimated budget. Richardson was ready. 5 days later, he sent back 10 pages in his chicken-scratch handwriting with the heading, Projected Journey of Discovery and Philanthropy to Central Africa via the Great Desert of Sahara. Richardson noted that expeditions attempting to enter Africa through the Gambia, the white man's grave, had been miserable failures, mostly because of the malevolent tropical climate. For Europeans, he wrote, the old north-south caravan routes through the desert were far healthier, aside from the problem of attacks by bandits. He proposed a route from Tripoli through the Fezzan to Merzouk, Ghat, and the Ayr Mountains, which had never been visited by Europeans. From there, south to Katsina and Hausa land, then east to the Kingdom of Bornu before turning due north back to Tripoli. The expedition's purposes, he continued, would be to persuade Africans to replace the slave trade with legitimate commerce, to sign trade agreements, and to collect information about the continent's peoples and places, and so promote the sciences and geography, language, ethnology, and general knowledge. He estimated the trip would take 1 to 2 years and cost, at most, £500, including the expense of gifts, to conciliate the princes and personages along the route. In a bow toward Palmerston's reputation for frugality, he added that the mission's success would not depend on a lavish budget or presents, but on the tact, prudence, and experience of the traveler. In the desert, the poverty of the traveler is oftentimes his greatest security. Richardson also proposed establishing a British consulate in the Northern Sahara at Ghat, a popular stopover for merchants traveling to and from Bornu and Timbuktu. Such a consulate would become a center of influence from which could radiate the light of British Christian civilization. If the government would fund an expedition to Central Africa, he concluded, we could undoubtedly, by perseverance and pacific policy, materially benefit and morally enlighten the African tribes and peoples, raising up degraded Africans to the standard of civilized Europe, and so expect, in humility, the favor and blessings of Almighty God upon us as a nation and the world at large.
We've just heard Labyrinth of Kingdoms by Steve Kemper. Canoeing the Congo is one man's epic 5-month solo attempt to canoe the Congo River in war-torn Central Africa. Phil Harwood is an ex-Royal Marine Commando, ski guide, expedition leader, and outdoor instructor. He is qualified as a mountain leader, a level 4 canoe coach, a level 3 kayak coach, a rock climbing instructor, a wilderness EMT, and a first aid instructor. His journey was a historic first descent from the river's true source in the highlands of Zambia. Just short of 3,000 miles long, the Congo is the 8th longest river in the world and its deepest, with a flow rate second only to the Amazon. During his adventure, Phil encountered waterfalls, huge rapids, man-eating crocodiles, hippos, and aggressive snakes. More dangerous were the endemic corruption, disease, and death threats. Phil, though, shares the tremendous hospitality he received from a proud and brave people, especially from the riverside fishermen who helped him whenever they could. On one stretch of river known as the Abattoir, due to its past history of cannibalism and current reputation for criminal activity, he hired 4 brothers with a shotgun to accompany him as his bodyguards. They paddled and floated for 5 days. Common questions from the locals along the way were, "Why haven't you cut his throat yet?" This terrifying and exhilarating journey is narrated by Gareth Armstrong.
My friend Pat and I were sitting out on our newly built patio behind our tent in the middle of the desert in northern Iraq in the spring of 1991. Earlier on that day, we'd stumbled across an abandoned marble factory while on patrol and taken quite a liking to a pile of rather expensive-looking paving slabs. Now, established on our makeshift extension, watching the sun go down and drinking tea, we were discussing what to do when we left the Marines. After much deliberation, we came to the conclusion that driving a Land Rover across Europe and Africa from London to Cape Town should be a cracking adventure. The idea caught hold. A few years later, in 1994, we were ready for the off. We had 21,000 kilometres and 21 countries ahead of us. The only thing holding us back was the fact that we had to push our 20-year-old Land Rover to get it started. As we swore at the thing on my mum's driveway, its failure to fire into life seemed like a bad omen for the trip to come. But once the engine started and we were roaring down the road, it went like a dream. We had no trouble for almost the entire journey, unless you count a punch-up in Gibraltar, nearly blowing ourselves up crossing a minefield, getting lost in the Sahara Desert, and encountering armed bandits. Really, it all seemed to go relatively smoothly. Okay, between us we also caught malaria, hookworm, ringworm, schistosomiasis, and typhoid. But those were minor issues. It was the trip of a lifetime. And the high point of that trip, as far as I was concerned, was the Democratic Republic of the Congo, or Zaire, as it was known back then. I'll never forget my first sight of the Congo itself in Kisangani, where locals call it the river that swallows all rivers. I saw something special in its dark waters. It was like a quietly brooding beast, almighty, yet momentarily at peace. All the stress of the long journey I'd taken to get there melted away. As I sat mesmerized, watching large clumps of water hyacinth float lazily by, the hairs on the back of my neck stood out. I was starting to imagine what it might be like to canoe the river from source to sea. The seed of another idea had been planted. This time, it only took 14 years to come to fruition, procrastination being the key stumbling block. Zaire more than lived up to its wild reputation, but it was the desperate poverty and raw honesty that had the most profound effect on me. I don't think I've ever been the same since, in a good way. My psychiatrist might tell you otherwise, but what the hell does he know? Driving through Zaire was frustrating, exhausting, liberating, and empowering, in that order. But it was frustrating in a good way, because for the first time in my life, I was forced to improvise, to think out of the box, and most importantly, to rekindle dormant instincts that are rarely required in the Western world. We had to live by our wits and slowly strip away all that our consumer society tells us should be important. I had known we were going to be in for one hell of an adventure from day one when we tried to cross over the Ubangi River border from the Central African Republic. At the crossing point, we had to find the ferry ourselves. The place was deserted, so we paddled in a dugout canoe across the sluggish brown river where we discovered the rusting ancient hulk of what looked like a derelict World War II pontoon craft. There were no vehicle tracks, no officials, and no soldiers. The only sign of humanity was an overgrown footpath, which would turn out to be the main road, heading off into the steaming thick jungle. Eventually, a lone man wandered out of the forest. His first words were, $200, I take you across river. Ours were, you're having a laugh, my friend, think again. 3 hours of haggling later, and we finally agreed on $10, at which point the guy told us the pontoon didn't work, and even if it did, he didn't have any fuel. So we canoed back and forth, carrying car batteries and diesel, trying to get it started. Finally, we had to turn an oversized crank handle deep in the engine room while standing ankle-deep in God knows what. We emerged successful, but soaked in oil and sweat. It felt like something out of the film The African Queen. And I loved every minute of it. I was hooked.
That was Canoeing the Congo by Phil Harwood. Guided by a Kazakh aphorism, to understand the wolf, you must put on his skin and look through its eyes, adventurer Tim Cope retraced the journeys of Genghis Khan. The author traveled by horseback across the entire length of the Eurasian steppe, from the ancient capital of Mongolia to the Danube River in Hungary. On the Trail of Genghis Khan, an epic journey through the lands of the nomads, chronicles an incredible 6,000-mile, three-year-long trip across formidable landscape and into the heart of the nomadic way of life that has dominated this region for thousands of years. Cope's trek takes him through wolf-infested plateaus, over glaciers and the sub-zero starving steppe, the scorching Kazakh desert, and the deep forests and treacherous mountains of the Carpathians. Alone except for a trusty dog and a succession of 13 horses, many stolen from him along the way, he encounters incredible hospitality from those who welcome him, a tradition that is the linchpin of human survival on the steppe. Immersed in the land and its people, Cope is witness to the rich past and often painful complexities of the present. Philip Rose performs the narrative.
After negotiating the steepest section of the valley, we had reached a broad, open meadow on the riverbank and set about making camp. Just as we were tying down the guy ropes, there came a howl from down the valley. "There must be a nomad family down there after all," I said to Catherine, fixing my eyes downstream, expecting to locate a nomad encampment. As I strained to focus in the fading light, the only white tinge to the landscape came from a ghostly rock that glowed from a slope of blackened dead trees. The howl came again, long and hound-like. From up the valley a similar cry echoed, then another from high in the forest on the far bank. Catherine tripped over our canvas duffel bag, then sat where she had fallen with her panicked eyes skirting the forest. Nothing moved, and again things fell silent. You secure the horses. I'm going for firewood, I stammered. Nomads had long cautioned me about wolves and thought us mad to be travelling without a gun. But I had always dismissed their warnings as scaremongering. During my studies in Finland, I had learned that, despite all the rumours and fear about wolves, there had only been a handful of recorded stories in history about attacks on humans. And even then, the victims had been babies or young children. It was only now that the real threat dawned on me. The wolves were interested not in us, but in our horses. If the horses were frightened enough to break free of their tethers and escape, what would we do? Night flooded in fast as I chopped away at standing trees, the axe first smashing its way through charcoal before hitting a core of dead, dry wood that was hard as steel. After an hour's work, I barely had enough wood to fill my outstretched arms, but nevertheless hurried back to camp. Without a gun, there were only two courses of action available. I urinated near each of the three horses, a trick long suggested to me by veterinarian Sheila Greenwell. Second, I lit a fire and rationed out the meagre wood supplies that would need to see us out until dawn. According to Mongolians, a fire would keep the wolves at bay. Once the fire was going, we relaxed somewhat and sat gazing into the flames, eating a mash of rice and rehydrated meat. As my tummy filled, I watched a deep blackness spill into the eastern sky and stars flicker on. After an hour or two had passed, with no sign of wolves, I collapsed in the tent, while Catherine took the first shift by the fire.
We've just heard On the Trail of Genghis Khan by Tim Cope. September 1996 found Phil Caputo on Barter Island, a wind-scoured rock in the Beaufort Sea, populated by 200 people of the Inupiaq. As he gazed upon an American flag above the only school for 150 miles, he marveled the children in that school pledged allegiance to the same flag as the children of Cuban immigrants in Key West, almost 6,000 miles away. Awed by America's vastness and diversity, and filled with a renewed appreciation for its cohesiveness, an idea began to form. With enough time, gas money, and nerve, he could drive from the southernmost point to the northernmost point of the U.S. reachable by road, talking to people as he went and trying to better understand what holds our great country together. His journey is chronicled in The Longest Road, Overland in Search of America, from Key West to the Arctic Ocean. Cicada-like, his idea went dormant, not to be reawakened for 14 years. In 2011, Caputo, who had just turned 70, his wife, and their two English setters, took off in a truck hauling an Airstream camper from Key West, Florida, en route via back roads and state routes to Dead Horse, Alaska. The journey took 4 months and covered 17,000 miles. Along the way, Caputo interviewed Americans from all walks of life to discover what their lives and the life of the nation are really about in the 21st century. Pete Larkin narrates.
What finger-shaped Florida lacks in breadth, it makes up for in length. Tallahassee is 480 miles from Miami. Further than New York City is from Cleveland. The two cities are separated by another greater distance. Miami has become a Latin American capital, home to Cubans, of course, but also Hondurans, Colombians, Brazilians. The city jumps to a salsa beat. You can drive the whole length of 8th Street, Calle Ocho, and swear by the billboards and storefront signs that you're in Havana or Bogota. Finding an English-language radio station is like an Easter egg hunt with no egg at the end. Country and Western dominated the AM and FM bands when we got to Tallahassee, and the signs did not require translation. Magnolia and live oak bearded with Spanish moss shaded clapboard homes in modest neighborhoods, and, in high-end precincts, the grounds of would-be Taras with white pillared porticos. We spent a day and a night with my son Mark and his wife Erin, and babysat our three granddaughters. Although the guest room was no bigger than the trailer, Leslie was delighted to sleep on a real bed in a space that didn't rest on wheels. The two women in my life weren't getting along. Leslie is practical, down-to-earth, and low-maintenance, and she doesn't suffer high-maintenance girly girls gladly. That described Ethel. Ethel was also unpredictable. The propane alarm had gone off again for no apparent reason. Now that I wasn't traveling alone, Mark's opinion of my sanity had moderated. He's a political reporter for the Miami Herald and helped me in my quest by arranging an interview with Dean Cannon, the Republican Speaker of the Florida House of Representatives. I met Cannon at a Starbucks in a Tallahassee suburb. Speaker of the House evokes an image of a craggy-faced eminence like Tip O'Neill. Cannon, though 42, looked so young I wanted to ask him what he was going to do when he got out of college. As I approached 70, almost everyone under 45 looked 18. I sought Cannon's opinions about what keeps our monster, mongrel nation in one piece. He replied with a lawyerly dissertation. The nation is held together for structural, cultural, and historical reasons. We have a federal, not a national government. It's the difference between steel and Kevlar. The structure is flexible enough to respect differences in diverse peoples and diverse states, but strong enough to hold things together. It's the only form of government capable of sustaining such a diversity of geography and ethnicity without everything blowing apart. There is a universal yearning in the human soul to be free, to be unfettered, and the degree of personal freedom we have here is greater than in any other country. You can start a business in your backyard. You can own a gun. You can travel from Florida to Alabama or Georgia without showing your papers. The Bill of Rights is our shared cultural legacy. We were born out of a group of brave, original thinkers. We had an unbuilt continent blessed by climate and soil, a country rich beyond compare. And at a key moment in history, they knew how to take the best of the best and build a new form of government. There wasn't a word I disagreed with, but I asked, if we had this wonderful system, why were so many people up in arms? Tea Partiers calling for secession, mainstream politicians hinting that armed revolt might be a viable option? You've got to distinguish. There are some Tea Party people who are angry social misfits. They're just crazy jerks. But I think the vast majority of Tea Party people I've spoken to aren't so much angry as they're afraid. Afraid of the country, for the first time in its existence, losing sight of the fact that liberty and personal freedoms are the primary characteristics distinguishing us from every other country in the free world. The gravest threat to liberty is too strong a central government.
We've just heard a sampling of The Longest Road by Philip Caputo. Readers, regard. The Book Report presents a title for those passionate about travel and food. When journalist Anne Ma's diplomat husband was given a 3-year assignment in Paris, Anne was overjoyed. A lifelong foodie and francophile, she immediately began plotting gastronomic adventures à deux. Then her husband was called away to Iraq on a year-long post. Suddenly, Anne's vision of a romantic sojourn in the City of Light was turned upside down. And the result is Mastering the Art of French Eating, Lessons in Food and Love from a Year in Paris. Not unlike another diplomatic wife, Julia Child, Anne had to find a life for herself in this new city. Journeying through Paris and the surrounding regions of France, Anne combated her loneliness by seeking out the perfect pain au chocolat. She enjoyed the history and taste of everything from beef bourguignon to buckwheat crepes. And somewhere between Paris and the south of France, she uncovered a few of life's truths. Both funny and intelligent, this is a story about love, of food, family, and France. It's about a self-discovery, one dish at a time. Mozhan Marno narrates.
I'm not a voracious carnivore, but there's something about being in Paris that makes me want to sink my teeth into a bloody piece of beef. Perhaps it's the French paradox, the seductive theory that a diet rich in cheese, meat, and red wine actually lowers cholesterol. Perhaps it's watching all those sexy French women purse their lipsticked mouths while slicing through a juicy chop. Steak frites is a relatively easy thing to order if, like me, you're still struggling to master those nasal French vowels. The words fly off the tongue without any hidden surprises, unlike, say, asking the waiter about preservatives only to find out you've interrogated him on condoms. But as I found out during one of my first meals in a classic Paris bistro, ordering a steak leads to more questions. Quelle cuisson désirez-vous? Said the waiter in an offhand way, like asking my date of birth or my hair color. He wore round glasses, a white shirt with a black bow tie, and a long black apron that reached past his knees. It was difficult to discern who was older, him or the desiccated leg of ham hanging from the ceiling in the middle of the room. Thus far, I had tricked the waiter into thinking I spoke French, but now, I realized, the jig was up. Medium, I thought, and tried a quick, desperate translation. Moyen? A look of weary disappointment crossed his face, but he'd been around enough American tourists to know what I meant. A point, he corrected me. Later, I would memorize all my steak vocabulary, the hot sear and chilled interior of bleu, the rosy glow of a point, the tough brown gnaw of bien cuit. I would learn how to enjoy a steak the French way, saignant, with a magenta center and juices that ran red. But at that moment, I just repeated the words after him and washed them down with a gulp of wine. I've wanted to live in Paris since I was six, when my family and I took a summer vacation to Europe. We went to London first, gray and proper, where we spent a week shivering into our teacups, even though it was mid-July, and I stared in terrified fascination at the mohawked punks in Piccadilly Circus. Then we arrived in Paris, which was ablaze in a high summer heat wave. It seemed alive, Paris, alive with warmth and days that never ended, and beautiful people on the streets wearing beautiful clothes and speaking a beautiful, strange language. Every aspect of the city assailed my senses, the grand buildings in pale limestone, the parks teeming with half-naked sunbathers, the taste of baguette dipped in chocolat chaud, the seesawing sound of the sirens, the imprint of wicker cafe chairs against my sticky thighs, the Coca-Cola poured from chilled glass bottles that turned tepid without ice cubes, the smell of fresh croissant and ripe cheese and human sweat. It was all so new and different from the only place I really knew, our home in the sterile suburbs of Southern California. I didn't like everything, but it all gripped me, holding me in an embrace that I would come to know was francophilia. The trip has gone down in Ma family lore as the nadir, or zenith, depending on who you're talking to, of my brother's rebellious teenage years. He spent a lot of time plugged into his Walkman, while my parents coped by drinking red wine. As our voyage continued, they, my parents and brother, seemed to grow more and more matted and worn, more impatient to return home to their own routines and clothes and space. In contrast, I became more energetic as the days passed. "I want to learn French," I proclaimed. It felt like my destiny. After all, hadn't my parents given me a French name, Anne-Marie? They responded with wan enthusiasm, dampened even further by the sticky oppression of our hotel room.
We've just heard Mastering the Art of French Eating by Anne Ma. Readers, travel memoirs touch on subjects that speak to all of us in these complex times. Love, instability, conflict, and curiosity. Truly rich fodder for some incredible storytelling. I hope you found some titles and some destinations that pique your curiosity. For more books to put on your agenda, check my website, bookreportradio.com. Thanks for journeying with me today, and join me in a week for the next edition of the Book Report.